Welcome to a new edition of the Famous Interviews with Joe Domino. On this episode, we talk with former corporate leader, author, and researcher, the great Guy Morris. Retiring from a 38-year leadership career with Fortune 500 software, high-tech, and global energy, with a reputation as a thought leader and an innovator in implementing multiple phases of leading-edge technology since the 80s, including early-stage AI, Guy maintains a very rich understanding of AI, with a focus on AI impact on society, economics, politics, and religion. He has also been a published songwriter for Disney Records, a pilot screenplay writer for Sojourn Entertainment, a patent inventor, a Coast Guard charter captain, a diver, adventurer, and an author of a series of multiple award-winning intelligent thrillers inspired by AI, politics, history, and religion. He's very thorough, has a wonderful story. Enjoy this interview.
It's great to meet you. Thank you for taking a minute out. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. And I want to begin our conversation with living through the last 3.5 years of this pandemic. How did you get through the pandemic and how has it changed you?
Well, you know, interesting. The pandemic was actually a kind of a boon for me, a little bit of a blessing, because I was working on, when it started, I was working on my first book. And I had retired. And so I wasn't really in meetings all the time. I wasn't having to commute. I wasn't having to, you know, we had to go to the grocery store and we had to be careful because my wife's mother at the time lived with us and lived nearby, and we see her a lot, and she's aged. So we didn't want to get her infected. I think it was more of the, for me, the biggest effect was to look at the divisions within the country, to look at what it did to our society. And it was scary for a lot of people not to go to work. It was scary for a lot of people not to know what was going to happen next and who was going to go next and how bad was this going to go. And I think that psychology, and then of course the divisions around vaccination versus not vaccination, was really frightening. So I think for me the hardest, the deepest effect was, it was the beginning of us really witnessing this, the some of the more radical divides in the country. And I think that was, I think, eye-opening. I mean, I grew up in this, in the 50s and 60s. I'm retired. You know, if you wanted to go to school, you had to have vaccinations. You know, the whole concept of vaccinations was not a big, you know, deep state, you know, kind of conspiracy of controlling us, or, you know, it's like I had witnessed people and knew people whose families were positively affected by having these diseases taken care of. So I wasn't an anti-vaxxer. I could see, I was a little concerned, I think, along with other people, that we were still learning how this particular disease worked. And I could understand the mentality of the Faucis of the world, the doctors who said, let's be more cautious than not, because it could be, you know, we were at the verge of basically collapsing our entire hospital system, which would have been an even worse disaster. So I've been involved in big infrastructure projects throughout my career, so I understand how government works and how big corporations work and how the system works. I could understand how some people were a little cautious. I could not understand some of the larger conspiracy fears and things. So it was, I actually, we came through it fine. We didn't get sick. We both got vaccinated. I'm normally a very, very healthy person who never gets the flu vaccine. I'm not a vaccine-aholic or anything like that. But I thought, well, for this one, for the sake of my mother-in-law, for the sake of others, to be respectful of others, it's better that I do it than not. But personally, we weren't that deeply affected. I was nose down morning, night, noon and night on my first book and getting that out the door. And I got it out November 2020. So okay. Right in that time frame.
So you've had a 38-year plus leadership career. Talk to me a little bit about your life prior to this world of writing.
I left graduate school with an MBA and undergraduate degrees in economics, finance, and a minor in computer science. I had been involved even before I graduated with designing and building a macroeconomic model that outperformed the Federal Reserve and every other bank in the nation, and changed how we build economic models to this day. And so I've spent my career basically working for companies like IBM, Occidental Petroleum, Oracle, Microsoft, and some startups, moving technology into the enterprise and teaching the enterprise how to be productive with all these new technologies that have happened over 40 years. Wow. So everything from when main computers first became the first desktop computers. I remember my first job, there was an IBM. Absolutely, hardly anybody had a personal computer. We all had terminals to the mainframe.
Yeah.
And so I've been involved in this incredible transition of society from individualized work and paper thinking to computerized productivity, to network productivity, to internet productivity, to big data productivity, to website applications that extended that productivity to from the company to the business to the customers. I've been involved in all of these transitions, and I'm not a developer. I've always been on the leadership management side, but it's been, I got to work with some of the smartest people on the planet. I got to work with some of the most powerful people on the planet. It's been an eye-opening, wonderful experience, and I'm very grateful.
So in all of this technological change, you understand my standpoint. I'm actually an IT technician for a school district, so I go into all the buildings and fix it. And I've been in technology for years and years. It's something that's just been a part of my DNA. But I'm curious, with you seeing this enormous swath of technology happen and evolve over this time, what's been the most impressive advancement that we've had in technology, according to what you've seen?
Artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
Artificial intelligence is unlike any other industrial revolution that we've had. Every other industrial revolution, and we're still in that transition from tool to entity, but we're in that transition, and that's what makes it important. For all of the millions of years of human evolution, we've been the smartest species on the planet. That is rapidly changing, and There's issues and risks on the technology side, but I don't try to overplay those. They do exist. We have to be very careful with them. We have to monitor, and we can, I think, believe we can manage those if we got together with a coherent mind. But technology is not evil or benign in and of itself. But this is going to be one of the most powerful, profound technologies that we've ever created. The ability we've now taught the machine how to think for itself. And it's continuing in that process. So as we go from the current GPT-4 platform with and the other similar platforms of Gemini and Ferret from Apple and others, with roughly an IQ of about 155, which is still smarter than 99% of the people on the planet, only 5 points less than Einstein. As we look at the growth rate that we've been seeing in these systems of 10 times every new generation, we're now looking at a IQ of the next generation that's going to exceed 1,000. And to be honest, we really don't honestly know what to do with that. The only thing that we do know for sure is if anybody who's been a student of history is that when you give power to people who are greedy, prideful, malicious, autocratic, we're dealing with how those people who are how dictators, despots, warlords, crime lords, politicians, corrupt politicians, sociopathic billionaires. I'm sure we could all name at least one, our favorite. You know, what are they going to do to this with this technology that's going to change our society in their favor? And how's that going to look? You know, the Goldman Sachs predicts that as many as 300 million up to 500 million jobs will be displaced between now and 2030. And the International Monetary Fund claims that as many as 40% of all jobs on the planet will be displaced. That's an enormous economic, social, spiritual, religious disruption that no one is prepared for. We're not prepared for it from an education perspective. We're not prepared from an economic and a budget deficit and a budget tax revenues perspective. We're not prepared for it from a job retraining and repurposing and giving people a new purpose in life. You're going to take people from core middle class jobs And so I've heard arguments to say, well, we'll install a universal basic income. You're going to take people who were making six figures a year and now tell them they're going to, you know, live on 20, you know, the basically poverty level income.
Yeah.
This, we're not ready for this.
Yeah.
And we're not ready for it in terms of regulations. We're not ready for it in terms of expectations. We're not ready for it in terms of morals and framework and boundaries. So one of the reasons I write books about the topic is not that I don't believe in the technology. I think the technology is incredible, but I've seen us abuse technology over and over. And that's what I fear.
Yeah, well said. I've seen two interviews with Elon Musk. Now, I've conducted a lot of interviews and had very good talks about AI, about this level of unknown, nothing dooms. But I'm telling you, Elon, both times it comes up, I see all the color go out of his face.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all I need to see.
I have a difficult time having confidence in a man who on one side of his mouth will say, we're summoning the demon. And on the other side of the mouth says, I built a new demon, buy mine.
Yeah.
There's something about that duplicity
that
just does not ring true.
Yeah.
One of those statements is true and the other one is manipulative. And we don't. And if I had to guess which one, that's my personal choice on how to guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. What did you want to be when you were a kid? What was your dream to grow up and become?
Ah, when I was a kid, boy, that was probably my first dream was to be a sailor because my dad was a Navy officer. But then I lost all dreams for many years. I had a very difficult childhood. I went to 16 schools before I dropped out in the 10th grade. I was a frequent survivor of severe abuse. I was a 13-year-old homeless runaway. And basically left home for good and with never going back again at age 15. So I've been on my own for most of the time. So most of the time growing up, I just wanted to survive. I just wanted to be in a home that looked like some of the other homes I saw from other people and some of the homes I saw on television, which looked like total fantasy to me. Watching shows like Leave It to Beaver was like, geez, you know, whoever, come on, you know, that's how unrealistic is that?
Yeah.
And I know people who said, oh, no, that's what my family life was like. And so for me, most of my growing up was just trying to escape. That said, I love the ocean. We lived in Hawaii for a while. I remember at 4 or 5 years old taking a cruise ship from Long Beach, California to Hawaii because we got relocated there. My dad was located in Honolulu, and that was how they shipped the families back at the time because plane flights were too expensive. And I just fell out. I remember, and very, very few memories from my childhood, but I remember this. I remember the last week or so before we had gotten to Hawaii, we ran into a storm. And apparently that's a pretty typical storm system that runs northeast of Hawaiian Islands. And we ran into the storm. Everyone on the ship, both of my brothers were sick. My mom wasn't feeling well. My brother's bed slid back and forth all night long. We got to the dining room that morning and it was almost empty. I felt great. I felt I had the whole ship to myself. I was running around on the decks saying, I own the ship. I own the ship. So there was something about the water that had always appealed to me. And, so after my divorce, one of the things I knew I had to do was to buy a large sailboat and live on that. So now that said, then in my teen years, I thought for sure I would be a musician because I wasn't educated. I wasn't really functionally literate, but I loved music. I taught myself several instruments. That was how you dug yourself out of poverty if you are street in LA, kid street in LA. Was to find a good band and ride the wave. Then I married too early. My wife got pregnant right away. And all of a sudden, I had to face the fact that I had to take care of a family. And that scared the living daylights out of me. I was given a unexpected, miraculous opportunity to go to college. And I saw it as a chance to change my stars. And so I took the bull by the horns. I had sleepless nights for 5 years. I think I slept an average of four hours a night. But I wanted to not only graduate, but I wanted to get the best opportunity I could to reinvent myself. And I had an affinity for finance, economics, and computers. So that fell into place.
So you probably needed to have a good hero growing up. Who was that for you? Who was an inspiration?
Hero growing up. Honestly, at the time, the Beatles. The Beatles and Paul Simon were probably two of the biggest ones. I was still fairly young when they were becoming really popular in the mid-60s. Learned about through all the publicity and everything else around each of them, around how they had basically kind of grown up in poor middle-class homes and how music had changed their lives. And they were an inspiration because it said that if they can change their lives, so can I. But they did it in a way that was on their own terms. They certainly had their own style. They certainly made a mark on the world. I've never made anything similar. I mean, few people in the world will ever make any kind of mark as similar as some of those. But that was an inspiration for me. For a time, I enjoyed sort of the Western heroes. John Wayne was a favorite, and until I learned that he would abuse his women. And coming from an abusive background, that kind of became a black mark for me.
Yeah.
So if you couldn't be a manly man without beating somebody else up, then you weren't manly man enough for me. So at the time that, certainly as a kid, it was cowboys and Indians, but soon it became musicians and different people who learn how to touch other people with their words.
Yeah. So what's the best advice you've ever gotten?
Wow, that's you caught me off guard with that one. Touche. I've had a lot of good advice. Invest in myself.
Yeah.
An investment in myself in terms of not an indulgence, an investment. An indulgence is to buy yourself a jet ski. An investment is to teach yourself a new trade. An investment is to learn something you didn't know, become a better person, grow in some sort of material fashion. And the advice went that no one's going to invest in you, and no one's going to reap the investments in you as much as you can. That everything about your life that you want comes from first not looking for someone else to fill that need, but for you to invest in yourself to be ready for the need when you're ready, when it comes. And that was one of the things that inspired me to work so hard in college, to achieve so much there, to go on to work with CXOs and CEOs throughout my career, to start businesses, to work on new innovations, work on early artificial intelligence. I've worked with generals and senators. And all of that comes from being willing to do the hard work. And it's been hard work to transform myself from an illiterate street kid to someone who could sit next to a CXO and with some credibility.
So of all of these people that you've met with, you've had a lot of adventures and you've had a lot of tales, I'm sure, to tell. What was the one person that you had the chance to be around that you looked forward to, that you genuinely liked as a human, that was really like good? And when you didn't talk business, if you had to talk, just otherwise, you look forward to it.
You know, I haven't had a lot of close friends in life because I've been busy. I work obsessively hard. I still work about 12 hours a day. His name was my a good friend named Jack Teeter. Now, I met Jack at a dinner party in Beverly Hills. We were both guests to a third party friend who owned the home. Jack was came out of the film industry. He was a started off in marketing at Universal, so he marketed films like really big ones with Jessica Lange and some of the big blockbusters that came out of Universal, Back to the Future, a number of different films he was involved in. And then he went into his own film production company, an indie film production company. And that was the phase when I knew him. And Jack was one of my best sailing buddies. So when I would, if I wanted to go out on a if the weather was, if there was a storm watch weather and nobody wanted to go out, and I had a really big heavy boat so I could do it, but when I wanted to go on a sailing adventure, Jack was there. When I wanted to do something creative, Jack was there. He's producing a documentary. His uncle was blind, but he was one of the most prolific engineers in the automotive industry in the 50s and 60s. He created cruise control and a number of other things. He's doing a documentary on his uncle now. My book Swarm started as a co-produced webisode series with Jack, where he basically helped me with some of the film shoots and everything else that went with producing the series. So Jack has always been a close friend. He was my best friend at my wedding. And when I would want to go on an adventure, Jack was always one up for an adventure. Whether we were ready or not, we would find out as we went. He was intelligent, he was creative, he was compassionate, he had a lot of empathy, he had a great sense of humor, which is always critically important for me. He was a good friend. Yeah.
So, of all the things that you've done professionally, what are you the proudest of?
That's a big list. I can tell you maybe the top two or three.
Okay.
Changing the way we develop macroeconomic models, and developing one that outperformed pretty much everyone. Now, my goal at the time was I made a deal with the dean of the college that if I could beat everybody, and we all had to build a macroeconomic model, but I wanted to, and we were going to get our grades based on how close we actually came to the actual numbers. So we had to test our model with real life. And I made a deal with him. I was poor. I didn't have any money. I was out of money at that point. I wanted to go to grad school. I couldn't afford grad school. If I could beat everyone else in the school, would he consider me for a scholarship? And he said he'd consider it. I was obsessive. I was in the data center from midnight to about 8 a.m. for every night for months, and tweaking and building and collecting data and testing algorithms, developing new algorithms to test a new theory that I had that had to do with technology and productivity and the GNP. And you remember Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve Chairman, talking for years about how the Federal Reserve had discovered the magic of productivity of technology and how that was influencing our economy. All of that was based on the work that I did.
Wow.
That was certainly, I think, one of the ones. And to be honest, it was a little hard for me to feel like I was kicking off my career with something like that. Still in school, thinking, okay, now I got to live up to this. Because when it gets to corporations, the skill set is not what you can think in your head in a dark laboratory in the bottom basement of a university building. It's how you organize other people. It's how you influence other people. It's relationships and being a street kid. Those were skills that took me longer to develop. The other one, though, was at Microsoft. And when I came into Microsoft's service group was essentially just propeller heads on a stick that the sales group would sell with a bunch of software boxes. Oh, you're going to buy a million cases of SQL. We'll say we'll give you a couple of database experts, to kind of help you install. But they wouldn't ever take responsibility for the project. They wouldn't take responsibility for implementing the technologies, and it was really hurting them in the marketplace. I came out of Oracle before that. I was doing multi-million dollar deals. And Microsoft Services was kind of a joke. And so my goal in going in was to transform Microsoft Services so that they could actually, it wouldn't be their core business because they had partners and they didn't want to upset their partners, but where Microsoft, when the customer wanted them to, could do a multi-million dollar deal and not lose their shirts or totally disrupt the customer's environment. And so I had to come into an organization that was firmly set against doing big projects and argue with them to allow me to establish a project management office within services, hire project managers, sell them into the businesses and these projects, manage and train them and monitor them, raise up our customer satisfaction levels, bring down our project losses on anything we tried to do that was complicated. And honestly, Microsoft is bad at this. We had one project where they did a fixed bid to the customer for $2 million and then wind up spending 18.
Wow.
So this was the kind of track record I was going in against. And I had several executives of the company tell me that I had just committed career suicide. And I knew it needed to be done. I knew it had to be done. And I figured I was probably one of the only people in the company foolish enough to risk his career on doing something that everyone else who had tried had failed at. But I succeeded. We built it up to, we had roughly about $750 million in value by the time I handed it over to the worldwide group. And then I started our large deal sales group. So in other words, I wanted to go out and get really, really, really good at winning those multi-million dollar deals, because we still were struggling on the sales side. I said, now that we know how to deliver them and I'm confident that I can deliver what we're selling, let me go try and go teach you guys how to sell these as well. And I did about 2 or 3 years of that program. Unfortunately, they brought in a new VP. I'd gone through about six VPs at that point. And they brought in a new VP from outside the company. He didn't, for whatever reason, didn't tend to like me. He wanted to bring in his own team from his old company, and he was looking for excuses to get rid of people. And when that was right about 2009, when the crash was happening and when their sales basically dipped, Microsoft did some layoffs, and he decided that if the business was not going to be doing a lot of large deals that year, he didn't need a large deal team. So he basically got rid of one of the most successful teams that they'd ever had.
Wow.
Now, as a result, he was such a bad manager, that was a sign. They wound up firing him about a year later, but not before he got rid of me. So I started a business at that point that failed. It was a great idea, totally the wrong time to do it. And then I went back and did some contracting for Microsoft for several years as a contractor and made some money that way. And then decided at one point that I was done and I was ready to retire.
So let me ask you this. After all of these roads and everything you've been down, everyone has a perception of you, your family, your friends, all the people that buy your book, everyone that's known you, but you ultimately run the show. What's your perception of you? Who do you think you are?
I'm a street kid who had a chance to change his stars and who was blessed with a pretty sharp intellect to help him get there. I have a gift for seeing complicated scenarios, such as economics, global economics, and seeing it almost as a matrix lever-based kind of mechanism where if I flip one level this way, it's going to have an effect that way. And so I see myself as a one person at Microsoft said, I know who you are. And I said, and I took a little bit of a personal affront to it. I said, well, what do you mean? I thought, oh, I'm a pretty honest guy. I said, you can't say anything bad. And he said, well, no, yeah, you're one of those scary smart guys. And I said, thank you. I think. But as a result, I'm in my best element when I'm in my data center, in my lab, in my office, when I'm trying to think through a new problem, think through something new, trying to innovate. on what others have done. Because I've still that street kid that I've never really felt 100% comfortable in big social settings. And that's always, I do well, but that's never where I feel comfortable. And I've always been aware that that was my level of discomfort.
So what was the first book, as a writer, what was the first book you ever read when you were young or at any point in your life that you come back to or that's been seminal?
The first book that I remember reading was in seventh grade, and it was sixth grade, and it was Swiss Family Robinson. And I loved the adventure of it. I loved it. It reminded me of the time I had spent in Hawaii in the tropics. I loved the humor of it. I loved the courage of it. But I didn't get the chance to do a lot of reading. My mom didn't really believe in libraries, and we moved so much it was hard to kind of really kind of build that up. I took up reading again in college, and Hemingway became one of my favorites. Mark Twain became another favorite. Edgar Allan Poe became another favorite and some of my darker moods. And I started learning some of the classics. But again, you get pulled into your job. You're working 80 plus hours a week. Reading for pleasure is not something you do, but I would do it when I was a fast reader. So if I would go on a business trip, I would always buy a book at the airport. I'd read it on the plane over, read it on the plane back, and I'd pretty much be done at that point. So that became my pleasure reading. So business trips became my chance to get a little pleasure reading in. And then, if I could ever get in a vacation, that was always a lot of books. So that instilled my love of reading. And in college, it was a little bit broader than just reading. I was impressed. It was more than impressed. I was inspired by men of the Renaissance. Men of the Renaissance were incredible, not only because they were their art. It wasn't just the art that they were looking at, but when to discover that they were also scientists, and they were also engineers, and they were also architects, and they were also understood business, and they understood religion, and they had a touch of the world across so many levels that allowed them to innovate between those intersections. And that always inspired me. So I think there was something about that I always wanted to emulate. I didn't want to just be, and I knew some of these guys who were specialists in one particular area, and you've known them. They're specialists. They're incredibly, incredibly deep in a very narrow niche. I guess it was appealed to me more to be, a few inches deep across 100 different fields.
Yeah.
And it was the ability to learn something about everything that excited me. By the time I started learning in college, I loved the ability to absorb the new information. I was watching some videos yesterday doing research for my next book that deals with consciousness and the theory, the emerging theory of in physics called the emergence theory, and how it looks like it's trying to combine the elements of quantum mechanics with traditional theory of relativity based physics and deals with consciousness and a number of other things. And I was telling my wife, and I saw the look in her eyes, and she said, "Oh Lord, he's going into one of his." And I said, "And I just said, okay, just admit it. You're married to a nerd." But I love learning, and I love growing, yeah. And I think that's one of the things that makes being an author so exciting for me, is I get to continue doing that.
So speaking of being an author, if anyone wants to pick up your book, learn more about you, anything about your world, where's the best place to go?
GuyMorrisBooks.com.
Excellent.
Find buy links there. You'll get video trailers. You'll get fact versus fiction. You can find highlights from all the amazing reviews I've gotten. My press kit is there. My expert video reel is there. A handful of the... I stopped putting them up there because they got so plentiful. Some of my early podcasts are up there. So it's a good place to start in terms of getting to know kind of what the books are about. Now, one of the things I like to tell people is that every single book is rooted, deeply rooted in either years of research and or experience to as feeding the premise. In my historical thriller, The Curse of Cortez, it took me 12 years to research the history, archaeology, and Mayan mythology that went into that book. Deals with a true billion-dollar abandoned plunder of Henry Morgan, why Morgan went insane and burned his logbooks to keep the world from knowing why he had abandoned it, and how that insanity, I connected it through events that led me all the way back to the origins of the Mayan creation myth. It's a modern-day thriller in the Dan Brown style. Book Trib even called it Indiana Jones meets Da Vinci Code. But it was an exploration to me of going through the mythology and the archaeology and the Mayan and all of this history to try and understand what happened to 30 tons of plunder, 3 ships, and 600 souls, and why that event was so traumatic to Morgan that he had to burn his logbooks to keep the world from knowing. My other books, my artificial intelligence books, were inspired when I discovered that a program I had already implemented early stage artificial intelligence in my business. So I was reading some materials and I discovered that a program had escaped the NSA spy labs at Sandia. It wasn't lost, didn't say it was stolen, didn't say it was broken. The word that they used was escaped. When I spent almost a year trying to reverse engineer and figure out how does a spy program escape the NSA, and then what did they design it to do that needed that pretty unique technology? They sent 2 FBI agents to my door. At first I thought it was a gag from Jack, my friend Jack. I thought he was gagging me. He hired some actors. They were put on a couple of cheap suits and they were showing up at my door to bust my chain. When I realized that they were real and they came in, they were very upset that I had figured out something they thought was supposed to be top secret. What bothered them more was my snarky attitude. I was like, yes, I did it. I figured it out. Oh, come on. Admit it, boys. You wouldn't be here if I was wrong.
Yeah.
I said, I can't wait to tell all of my friends. They got this pale look. They looked at each other like that's not the reaction we were expecting. They gave me the "we are not amused" speech. Then my wife came home and pulled me aside and wanted to know why there were 2 FBI agents at my door. And it got down to, what did I do? You know, so it's my fault. What did I do? So that was a really eye-opening experience for me as well, because it started me. I had been working in commercial technology for decades. And it started me considering and thinking and putting my James Bond Q mentality on to say, well, how would I be using these technologies if I were the government, if I were the CIA or the NSA or the espionage? What would I do if I were in DARPA and I wanted to put these into weapon systems? And so it got me focused a bit on how these technologies were being used in more dangerous and provocative ways.
Guy, I didn't mean to, I don't want to cut you off, but this is going to end in like a minute. We're going to go off here. So thank you so much. This has been a pure joy. Thank you for your time, and what a wonderful story of overcoming and success. So thank you, sir, for your time today. I appreciate
it. Appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning into another Famous Interview with Joe Domino, where we cover the world of art, literature, business, spirituality, music, and more from around the globe. Our esteemed theme music was composed and produced by the great E.E. Pointer of Kansas City's River Cow Orchestra. If you want to hear more interviews, visit the Famous Interviews with Joe Domino channel on YouTube. You can also find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.